More healthy couples than ever before are struggling to have a baby, and most have no idea why. We're eating healthier, we're exercising more, we're living longer, and yet fertility rates continue to decline around the world. So what's really happening? Today, we're separating fact from fiction and uncovering what every person needs to know before it's too late. Welcome back to the show. Today's conversation is one that I believe everyone should be listening to. Not just couples trying to have children, but young adults, parents, and anyone who cares about their long-term health. So for years, we've been told that infertility is someone else's problem. But today, more healthy people than ever are struggling to conceive. And many are completely blindsided when it happens to them. So what has changed? Is it our environment? Is it our lifestyle? Is it stress? Is it age? Or are we just missing the bigger picture? Joining us is one of the true pioneers in reproductive medicine. Dr. Sherman Seilber has spent decades helping families who were told they would never have children. So his groundbreaking work has transformed fertility care worldwide. And what makes it so remarkable isn't just the science. It's the compassion he brings to every patient and his willingness to challenge conventional thinking, even when the evidence points to a different direction. So it's such a privilege to welcome you back. Love having you here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, I always love being with you. You always have these very insightful and big questions, actually. So what is really happening? We are seeing more and more older couples, women and men in their 40s and 50s. And in previous era, this would be couples in their 20s and maybe in their 30s. So what's really happening is that society, of course, is changing for the better for women. And when it's better for women, it's better for men. And women have a better opportunity to do what they want to do. They don't have to get married when they're 20 years old to the first guy that maybe is available for security. And they can be independent. And so couples in general are thinking about getting married in their 30s, and then they're not thinking about having children until they're in their 40s often. And the problem is this. God was a little unfair about this. Men continue to keep making sperm until they're 120 years old. They have spermatogenic stem cells. But women have all the eggs they're ever going to have when they're just a fetus. And they lose these eggs gradually as they get older. And it is a double whammy. Not only do they have less eggs when they get older, but the baby rate per egg goes down. So the eggs that are remaining are less fertile. So in the old days, men would come into a vasectomy clinic when they're 25 and have had three children to have a vasectomy. But and they've already had their three children, and they figure it's their turn to be responsible for birth control. That was very common when I was a young doctor. But now, couples, it's not 100%, but many couples, huge numbers of couples, aren't really even tying the knot until they're in their mid-30s or 40s. And even then, they're not thinking about having the responsibility of children until they're in their 30s, late 30s. So the we did a study published in 2017, the intrinsic fertility of the human egg. And we did a graph with 24,000 patients undergoing natural cycle single embryo transfer or IVF. So we could determine what was the baby rate per egg naturally. And naturally, you could see that in the 20s, years 20s, the eggs would get a little bit less fertile up to age 30. And then it began to drop more quickly, I mean. And by age 35, there was a dramatic drop in the baby rate per egg. So that's a real defined parameter, the fertility per egg. So we just know that the eggs get less fertile much more rapidly than people think. Because when you're in your 30s, you figure you're in the prime of your youth. When you're in your 40s and your 50s nowadays, you're just beginning to get rolling with your life, and you're planning, all of us are planning to live to 100, and many of us are going to make that. And we just don't start thinking about having babies until the eggs are either less in number or less fertile or both. That's what's really happening in the developing world everywhere.
Yeah, it's so true. Women are have so much more choice these days, and conversations about babies aren't starting when they're 16 anymore. Like, that's the way it used to be. So is it just that people are waiting too long to learn about fertility? Do you think that these conversations should be starting much earlier to plan for the future?
Well, yes, younger couples, men and women, have to know about this, but they really don't listen at that young age usually. Mm-hmm. When you talk to a woman, if I were the king, I would say every woman in her early 20s should probably have her eggs frozen or to have ovary tissue frozen for the future. Simple thing to do, and then that guarantees them when they're 40 or 50, they can have children. But they don't even think that way. Don't bother me. I'm 23. I got all the time in the world. I'm young. I'm going to live forever. And they're very resistant to hearing this admonition. So what do we do? Well, right now in our clinic, since we see all these older patients that have not taken the liberty of freezing their eggs or freezing ovary tissue, we have to figure out how to work with older eggs. And that's what we're really doing with our whole approach to mini IVF. When a woman has hardly any eggs left at all and she thinks she's in menopause, in many cases, we can squeeze an egg out of her with a different stimulation protocol. And those are very precious eggs. So IVF clinics now have to really focus on how to have good results with older. And I have to say older women, because the age of the man is not significant. Sounds unfair, but God was unfair about that.
Wow. Yeah. I also hear a lot of people talk about stress being a factor in remaining, like not being able to have a baby. And also some people talk about like what's in our foods that are causing infertility. Is that true at all, or is that just a myth?
I wrote in my earlier books that stress used to be a big problem, and I wrote that. What can happen is stress can affect this primitive region of the brain called the hypothalamus. That's the same region of the brain that can be responsible for eating disorders, and it releases this hormone pulse and a pulse that I will GnRH. And stress can affect this hypothalamus, this very primitive region of the brain, so that it's not really acting right, and you can get maybe irregular cycles, poor ovulation. It can impact the ovulation. Stress can also cause contractions in the uterus that you don't see normally unless you do ultrasound and then speed it up rapidly, and then you can begin to see these contractions. And the contractions are much more frequent under stress. So stress can have an impact. There is no question about that. We used to tell stories in the old days about how when a woman finally got pregnant in her 20s after 4 years of infertility, then all of a sudden she'd get other babies easily after that. Or she didn't adopt a baby and then all of a sudden get pregnant naturally because the stress was off. That was a common story. But those were in the days when we were dealing with young women with infertility. That's very, very unlikely to happen now when the problem is just older eggs. So I think the major reason that we're seeing this epidemic of infertility around the developed world is the aging egg rather than the stress of modern life.
Right. So then how much of our modern lifestyle actually affects fertility?
Well, it can have an impact. For example, I tell patients this. After ovulation, the egg is only good for about 8 to 12 hours. We know that. And the sperm, however, after intercourse, should be around for about 2 days or 3 days. Wow. So couples are all buying these for ovulation kits. And it's a $2 billion a year industry, and they're trying to figure out exactly when they ovulate. But that's a mistake, because you're going to miss it most of the time. The best approach, and the husbands love this, is make sure to have intercourse at least 3 or 4 times a week. You want sperm to always be there whenever you ovulate. If you try to time it, the sperm can be in and out, and you miss that 8 to 12 hour window when the eggs are actually able to be fertilized. So a better strategy than trying to save it up and time your intercourse is to make sure sperm are always there. Now, first place, that can put a lot of stress on a couple. And I tell them, well, don't follow my advice if it's going to cause stress and misery. But try to enjoy intercourse and do it more frequently instead of making intercourse a job and saving it up and doing it that one time when this little test you bought at the pharmacy tells you you're ready, because that test is not accurate.
Yeah, it definitely can be stressful. There's something when it's on the calendar, it feels like you said, like it's a job and you're tonight we have to have sex. And there's something that is a turnoff about that, right? Like spontaneous and enjoying it, making it fun versus we have to have sex because this little test said that it's go time kind of thing. So yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, stress should be sex. Sorry, stress has a Freudian slip, but sex should just be an expression of love and spontaneity. And frankly, that's the best way to make sure there's always sperm present.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything happening today that genuinely worries you about our future generations when it comes to fertility?
Well, I'm not sure if I'm saying it's worrying me, but we have to face it. We wrote a paper in Nature a long time ago that, see, no matter how low the sperm count is, we can inject the sperm into the egg. We developed that procedure called ICSI, and we invented it back in the mid-90s. And no matter how poor the sperm count or the male infertility may be, we can do IVF and pick up that sperm and inject it into the egg. Well, so that means that there is going to be a whole generation of offspring who've inherited low sperm count, and those men will have low sperm counts. And we figured out it's going to be like compound interest. And well, in 20,000 years, the majority of men will either not have any sperm or will have very, very low sperm counts and will need IVF ICSI. It'll take about 20,000 years for that to happen. But the point is there will be an increasing percentage of male infertility in subsequent generations simply because we can treat it successfully with ICSI in the present generation. So I can't say it worries me, but it's just going to be an interesting phenomenon that couples may be prepared for in two or three generations from now. More and more cases of infertility will be resolving around low sperm counts.
I was just going to ask you what role the male fertility plays in this conversation. And I know we're going to do a future episode just on male fertility, but do you think we spend enough time talking about men?
Well, that's always been a complaint. We don't spend much time talking about men. The male fertility problem practically today is solved because of this ICSI procedure. There are very few cases where there's zero sperm. And if there's just a little bit more than zero sperm, two or three or four sperm, I mean, not 5 million or 50 million or 100 million sperm, which is considered normal, but just two or three sperm, we can inject them into the egg and have good results. And so the female issue is the main thing we're talking about because it's so difficult to deal with the decreased fertility of an aging oocyte because women aren't making new oocytes every day and men are making new sperm every day. So, no, I think it's okay that we're not focusing on the male so much now because there's nothing we can do to raise his sperm count. All we can do is solve the problem by injecting the sperm into the egg, and that does solve the problem. But in terms of the biochemistry and the genetics of male reproduction, we've studied that. We were the first to find the Y chromosome deletions, and I think we've discovered 30% of the genes that are responsible for azoospermia and low sperm count. So I've always been interested in studying the male. However, I think the male situations get worse and worse in future generations. And right now we're stuck with the biggest problem being the aging oocyte. And what's happened to society is good because women can get their degrees and get great jobs and have an independent life. And they don't have to just marry some guy at 20 for security and then be afraid to get divorced again because of insecurity. Men and women are equal, and it wasn't the case three generations ago. And so it's a great thing for everybody. And when women are equal, then that's better for men also. We all know that. And so it is, you know, and so society has changed in a way that's great. And it's created a secondary complication of couples just not thinking about having a baby till they're older and the eggs aren't very good anymore. So we've got, right now we're focusing our attention on two things. One is trying to get women to be willing to freeze eggs or ovary tissue when they're younger. That's a hard sell. But also when they come at an older age, to figure out how to actually use those eggs as efficiently as possible so that we can get good pregnancy rates even with older women.
So I have an interesting question. It's more like an observation, but I know a few generations ago, couples were having multiple babies versus today, you rarely hear of a couple having, you know, 5 or 6 children. Why was there such a increase of babies back in the day versus now? Do you think it's like lifestyle? I'm just curious if there's anything that you can tell us that I don't already know.
Well, yeah, it is. It really is interesting. I think most couples before 1960 would have lots of children because contraception wasn't readily available and easily available. They never thought of that. And they just kept on having children. However, then be there in the 60s and 70s, there came across this idea that you can do more for your child if you have less children. And we certainly don't want to overpopulate the earth beyond the ecological resources of the earth. So those were very big movements. Well, now Malthus has been proved to be wrong in that the means of subsistence can multiply geometrically and the earth can support more people. I mean, we certainly are making enough food to feed the entire planet. No one should have to go hungry. The problem there is political, distributional, and sociological. But we have the technology where we can easily feed the entire world, but we have to grow up from a point of view of politics and government and social structure. So the ecology is less on people's minds. There is the issue, of course, of global warming, but that can be attacked with technology also, such as, you know, electric cars and just watching out for increasing greenhouse gases and having control over that. It's possible to control all of that. So therefore, the planet really can tolerate more children right now. But I think many people are still thinking, let's not overcrowd the planet. Let's not overcrowd our family. Let's do the best we can for the few children we do have. And that's the general thinking. Now, some people, however, have a different view. And they have many children. The old Catholic family, the old Orthodox Jewish family, and those kids all do great because they have a sense of security provided for them by having such a big family, a cohort of people that are a cluster of people that can depend upon. So in some groups, they're still having 5 or 6 or 7 children, and they're very happy about it. I don't have a personal opinion about what's good or bad, as long as they're all fruitful citizens that have had opportunity, then, you know, be fruitful and multiply is my view.
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. Is there anything that does involve, like, the way that we're eating these days? Like, does processed food affect fertility? Is there something that people could be doing every day that may unknowingly be affecting their reproductive health in any way?
Yeah, you hit it well. I didn't pick that up, but you hit it perfectly with that question. This processed food is a disaster. I mean, people don't even realize how many calories they're taking in. And obesity, 40% of in developing countries, developed countries like America, 40% of people are what I would define as obese. I mean, maybe we call it overweight, but they have BMIs of over 30, and that's considered normal. The surgeon, only your surgeon really knows, because when you operate on the abdomen and people look normal by our way of thinking now, and they have fat pads that are that thick. And
yeah.
if you look in countries in Asia, you know, a surgeon is a pleasure because you have hardly any fat to wade your way through. We don't realize just how massively overweight we are. And I don't think it's coming from eating quality food. I think it's coming from all this stuff in plastic bags. Jane Fonda once said, try to avoid eating anything in a plastic bag. It's, you know, I went to the grocery store the other day and I bought some tuna loin and some chicken and a week's worth of food, and it was $24. I mean, that's what you would pay for a couple of bags of potato chips. So you can eat very, very healthy and not be overweight and get all the nutrition you need from just eating food and not processed junk. And yet processed junk is what the majority of us spend, as most of our diets are processed junk, really. So you're right about that. Now, what happens is you become overweight, to answer your question directly, and all those fat cells absorb estrogen, and the estrogen suppresses pituitary hormones. And so you get PCOS. They're calling it PMOS now, but I still prefer the old term PCOS. And so you either don't ovulate or you ovulate late in the cycle, you get irregular cycles. And if you just lose all that excess weight, you start ovulating normally. And assuming you're not, you know, 42 years old and you're 24 years old, as soon as you start ovulating normally, you'll just get pregnant naturally and you don't even need any of our treatments. So you made a very, very good point. The bad quality food that so many of us are eating is definitely having an impact on infertility in younger people.
And we're not really set up for success. I'm currently moving and I don't have a lot of food in my fridge, so I've been eating out more than I usually do. And I'm one of those who shops on the outskirts of the grocery store where I'm getting like all the healthy stuff. But I found over the past few days when I've been like, okay, I need to eat now, and I'm looking for a place to go grab something healthy, the choices are few and far between. I would have to drive like 20 minutes to go to like a really healthy restaurant that is considered to be really healthy. And that was really frustrating. So I ended up going to the grocery store and just picking up a few different things to make myself. But we're definitely not being set up for success when it comes to that stuff. Eating on the go is becoming so popular, but the choices to do that are few and far between if we want to stay healthy.
Well, you make a very powerful point. I mean, what is there available? I have to go out to eat also a lot when I'm out of town because we have a lot of scientific meetings I go to and there's a lot of interaction. And these scientific meetings are very important. And we always go out to eat. And it's very hard to find anything healthy in restaurants nowadays. You really have to look pretty far. They put all kinds of stuff on it. They want you to like it. And the chefs are very fancy about it. And yeah. You don't realize how enormous the calories and the fat content and how the nutrition has often been cooked out of it. You bring up a powerful point. So if you really, I don't know how to solve that other than when you go out to eat, find some little grocery store somewhere and then make sure you have an oven in your hotel room and cook it.
Yeah.
Or else just eat raw broccoli. That's and carrots and things like that. Yeah, that is a problem. You're absolutely right. And that doesn't change the fact that the biggest problem is older eggs. However, younger women are also finding themselves infertile. And you brought it up, I didn't, but you were right, because of our terrible nutrition.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So for someone out there, let's shift from fear to action. If someone listening wants to protect their fertility, where do they begin?
Something. There have been very meticulous nutritional studies done by scientists, not just by people that are trying to sell self-help books, but true scientists. And what they found out is that if you really don't know much about the dietary content of food, just eat a multicolored diet. If you just will eat, I mean, orange and red and pink and purple and black and white and brown, because it can include food or meat or fish or whatever, But if you have a multicolored diet, then you can be sure you'll be having a good diet. So it's a very, very easy, simple thing to fall back on. So that's one of the first steps everyone should take, really, in terms of their reproductive health and their health in general. But otherwise, I think it's a very hard sell to young people, to young women, and it costs money, unfortunately. But certainly before they're 30, they should freeze their eggs or their ovarian tissue. And, you know, the ovarian tissue can be transplanted back later when they're 50 and they don't have to go through menopause. So that's a side benefit. But the eggs won't do that. But at least you'll have young eggs you can use for IVF. And the pregnancy rate with young eggs is just so fantastic compared to with older eggs that they're just giving themselves an insurance policy. Now, many, many young women will say, you know what? I love my exciting life. I really don't want to have children. Children are a pain in the neck. Why would I want children? By the time they're 45, they want children. I've seen that. And so why not just have an insurance policy?
Yeah, I like that. Women especially, well, I know I'm thinking back to myself. I was so stubborn in my 20s that if someone told me that I should do something, I would, you know, not, because you're not thinking like that. But I really do think that we should start thinking like that. But you worked some miracles with what would be considered miracles with people that have lost all hope of getting pregnant. So having your eggs frozen or not, is there always a solution in your opinion?
Yes, there is always a solution, always. And I can detail that. In other words, nobody should go childless that doesn't want to go childless. So let's take the worst case scenario, of course, is older eggs. And with many women who are in their early 40s, late 30s, they have very few eggs and they've been to an IVF center and their cycles are canceled because there's only a few follicles. We found that by stimulating them with a very minimal protocol, we can squeeze out the best quality eggs and we can store them up. Even if she's starting at 38 or 40 or 43, we can store them up and then we have a reasonable success rate. Say a 43-year-old woman and we have six eggs we've managed to squeeze out of her, leading to maybe three blastocysts. Well, despite the fact that she's 43 years old, she'll have about a 45% chance of at least one baby. And that's pretty amazing. And even a 40-year-old with the same story, she'll have at least a 60% chance of at least one baby. So although their fertility has gone down, it's a very reasonable, tangible pregnancy rate. Now, when you get up to 47, it's rare success with their own eggs. Or with 50, it's obviously remote. However, let me get into a subject then that is a tough one, and that's donor eggs. Now, nobody really wants donor eggs. They want their own DNA. But we've been using donor eggs since 1986 in women that completely ran out of eggs. And it's always the same. They want their own DNA, but if they can't have their own DNA, at least they want a baby. So we've had 46 years of experience watching these kids grow up, and more than that, actually, and we don't have any unhappy stories. And that's unusual because there are parents that are unhappy with their children that they got easily and naturally. So why would it's uniformly happy stories? And the reason is this: we can easily match appearance and background and ethnicity and race and what you look like, tall or short or red hair or black hair and pale skin or dark skin. We can easily match so it doesn't look unusual, but that isn't what's important. What you can't match for, and this can be a positive statement, are five intangibles: personality, character, intelligence, emotional stability, and bonding with you as mother. But those five attributes in the baby are not in the DNA. They are intangible, and they arise very early in the first several years of life from how you interact with the baby. And it's not like programming. It's just a healthy emotional interaction with the baby, and you'll always get a good result. And that's those first two or three years that are so crucial. So these people that had to use donor eggs are so, so focused on the baby because they've gone through so much. And they've thought about it so much, and they're intent on the baby. The baby isn't just something that happened at 22 years of age as an accident in the backseat of a car. The baby is really something that they worked for. And those babies all turn out great, confident, intelligent, happy, emotionally stable. And so if it's not your DNA, because you're 50 and you run out of eggs, it'll still be your baby. So. Mm-hmm. Now, what if you don't have a uterus? If you don't have a uterus? Well, you can always do a uterine transplant, but I think that's extreme. If anybody could do it, we could do it with our microsurgical expertise and fame for that. But I don't think that's the best way to go. In America, there are 20,000 women willing to be gestational surrogates who love being pregnant but just don't want any more children than they already have. And so even if you don't have a uterus, can take your embryos and put them in a gestational surrogate. And the law in the U.S. is wonderful. The law is very clear that the intended parent is the parent. So there's no ambiguity about who the parent is. So I don't know. I can't think of a single terribly difficult case, absent uterus, absent ovaries, no eggs. I can't think of a single case where they can't have children.
Yeah, I think it only speaking to the people who maybe don't have an open mind or, you know, they can't look past that their baby might not have their own DNA, like just those people. But I mean, like you said, once the baby comes, all of that goes out the window because you got this beautiful baby and you can shower this child with love and bring them up the way that, you know, is healthy so that they do really thrive in the world. So you're right. I think there's a solution everywhere here. I'm curious, why do those women love being pregnant?
Well, there are just so many women who've already had, they have to have already had children, and they just love being pregnant, and but they don't want any more children. They want to hand the baby off. There's at least 20,000 women like that in the United States, and we can easily find them. And, it's a great thing because the law recognizes that the parent is the intended parent. And so it's a very safe process to go through.
So I'd love for you to tell us maybe a patient story that has stayed with you all these years and that continues to remind you why you continue doing this work. Where does your passion come from?
Well, if you want to hear a patient story, it comes up every day. We had a patient last week, a man who had little testicles, and he had undergone elsewhere a procedure to try to retrieve sperm because he had no sperm in the ejaculate. And in that process, they destroyed that one of those testicles, luckily just one of them. So he could function fine with one testicle, but it was really scary to try the other one. So he came to us, and we're the ones that invented that procedure. Microsurgically, we were very careful not to do any harm to the testes, just to stay on the outer rim so we didn't devascularize it. And after 4 hours of searching, we found 5 sperm. And the wife had 5 eggs. So we're talking about tiny numbers.
Wow.
And so we injected those 5 eggs, and 4 of them fertilized. And the joke of it is we did no harm, so we could do this again if we had to, if we wanted more children. So that just happened. Something like this happens every week where we have just fantastic cases because we see people that have given up hope, and there's never any reason to give up hope.
That's amazing. Yeah, I can't imagine them coming in and feeling so defeated and then after leaving and just feeling so free and happy and excited about life. I feel like a lot of times we're our worst enemy and we always tell ourselves worst case scenario. But that's why it's so important to sort of seek out doctors, like you have the conversation, because there's always a solution, like you said.
Yeah, and you know, I have a motto that in the history of the world, nothing has ever been accomplished by pessimists.
Yeah, I love that. That makes so much sense. I second that. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show and for talking about this stuff. Like I said, it's so important, especially now. And as we talked about before, people, couples are waiting so much longer to have children. So is there any last minute things you want to leave the audience with on this topic?
Well, certainly. That's always the open-ended question. The reason eventually everybody wants children, even though they didn't think they would want them when they're young, is that it's your continuity into the next generation. It's your shot at immortality. We all want to be connected and being connected to others. Religion is about connection. We all want to be connected. And so it's your connection to the next generation. And so sooner or later, that it's intrinsic to us and you'll have that feeling. But even if you put it off and it becomes trickier, everybody can have children. And that's the major message I want to leave.
Do you hear that, you guys? Everybody can have children. So thank you, Dr. Stalber, for being here today and for having this conversation. It's always so much fun talking to you.
And it's fun talking with you. Your questions always open up big things.
Love it. Love it. That's what we're doing. Let's affect the world in big ways, for sure. So looking forward to that next conversation on male fertility. I think that's going to be a really interesting one. Because like we said, we don't talk about men a lot, but I think it's worth the conversation and the time. And I also want to thank our audience for tuning in. So today's conversation wasn't just about infertility. It was about understanding our health before there's a problem. So knowledge is power, and your ability to explain these complex science questions, as the doctor did, it gives people clarity, hope, and is one of the reasons that this doctor has changed so many lives. So to anyone listening, if this episode made you think differently about your health or someone you love, please share it with someone that you love or someone that may be going through this to help them get clarity and the answers. As I said, knowledge is power. So thanks everyone again for tuning in, and stay tuned for the next episode. Take care, everyone. Bye for now.